Oscar, another Sterling Prize, her dynamic and theatrical buildings are unveiling across four continents. I spoke at length to Zaha for the Sunday feature, and in the programme we attend the opening of her new Maxi Contemporary Art Gallery in Rome, the Transport Museum on the Clyde that opens in the spring, the acclaimed new Academy School in Brixton, and of course the Aquatic Centre on the 2012 Olympic site. We find out what drives Zaha now that she's no longer an architect in waiting, but mistress of a 400-strong studio that is, to quote one critic, making the weather in world architecture. That's this evening here on Radio 3 at 9:30 p.m.
And now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The novelist and poet Adam Foles has had considerable success with his published work thus far. The first novel, The Truth About These Strange Times, won a Betty Trask Award, and The Quickening Maze, published in 2009, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. The Broken Word, a long epic poem, won the Costa Poetry Prize. Your choice of music reveals a very curious ear. You're not limited to any particular century, or at least not from looking at the list.
No, although the 19th century is conspicuously missing, I felt it was too difficult to make selections within those great works. I could very easily fill an hour with Beethoven or Mozart or Bach and so on. So really, I made my list wanting to explore some things which I do adore and listen to very regularly. It's something of a taster menu of short pieces which all excite me in different ways.
I thought in some funny way that the Nicholas Ludford, with which you begin, although it's from a different period, accompanied rather nicely your latest book, looking back at a period in history which you obviously touched by. I mean, John Clare in the most recent novel. I don't know why, it's something to do with the English sensibility, I guess.
Yes, it's true. The Ludford, despite coming from a very different world, a Catholic Renaissance English world, does feel very redolent of a certain Englishness, which reminds me of other manifestations of it musically in Vaughan Williams and Tippett, I think, particularly. There is something that always brings to mind the English landscape for me, and it's a very exciting and radiant vision that it brings.
It is quite extraordinary music, and it's very early. So he was born in 1485, I think, Ludwig.
Indeed, it's intensely beautiful. I've been listening to that particular recording for a long time, I guess more than 15 years, and it never fails to exhilarate and assuage in that way that great music does. There's something also, I think it has a doubled treble line at the top, which gives it this very airborne and uplifting quality. I just adore it.
Well, that was the Gloria from Nicholas Ludford's Missa Videte Miraculum. Andrew Carwood directed the Cardinal's music. Do you find in music an abstraction that you also seek in your writing, or do you see them as a very different thing?
I think the parallels between literary writing and music are interesting but limited. My relationship, or my work's relationship with music, often has to do with using music to sustain a mood, a mindset, an atmosphere during the course of writing something. So certainly music does play a large part in my creative life, but it's not really in terms of thinking directly about the musicality of writing. I think about prosody, and I think about cadence in a very separate way when I'm thinking about literature.
But you're interested in aspects of modernism in both disciplines.
Absolutely. Well, we'll come on to talk about Janáček later with one of my choices, but I think in some ways he is really a talismanic figure for what that means for me, and that has to do with writing without cliché and purposefully and with great intensity and radiance and kind of formal freedom, but also remaining true and owning up to the sort of the big experiences of life and not seeking always to vitiate them in the way that the Flaubertian line in modernism demands that you should.
Schoenberg is a fascinating figure inasmuch as one could listen to his early music and think, this is an extremely indulgent musical mind. Something like Gurlieder, for example.
Yes, absolutely.
And then there's that extraordinary move, fairly swift, into something which the scalpel is being wielded and extraneous ideas excised.
Yes, the Schoenberg that I like most is often in that period of the expanded tonality before serialism. However, the piece I've chosen, I think, is serially composed, but is amongst his serial works, many of which I love also. But this is a very rather informal and expansive one. This is the Opus 24 Serenade, which he wrote for a very memorable and distinctive chamber ensemble. This dancing movement, which we will hear, is full of wit, as the whole piece is, and kind of exuberant creativity, and also intense beauty. And I really wanted to make the point with this piece that Schoenberg is a very beautiful composer. He makes gorgeous sounds, and he's often very easy and seductive composer to listen to.
Thank you. The dancing fifth movement from the Serenade, Opus 24 by Schoenberg, Tanzszene, the London Sinfonietta, conducted by David Atherton. It would be lovely to hear a bit of your long verse poem, and perhaps we should set it up a little bit and describe how we arrive at the section you're about to read us.
The section I'm going to read is late in the narrative. The main body of the poem has been concerned with is the fate of a young English boy who's in summer between school and university.
Tom,
this is, who returns home to Kenya to the family farm in the mid-50s and gets caught up in the violence of the Mau Mau uprising, which is very extreme and takes him from situation to situation in this accelerating and terrible chain of events. Where I'm going to read from comes after that, and when he's eventually found his way to Oxford and is dealing with having had these experiences and having nowhere to voice them, and struggling to come to terms with leading a normal life again, essentially. He has fallen in love with a girl, and this section that I'm going to read is pertinent because it describes a concert, which is his decision for their first date, and it takes place in the Holywell Music Room in Oxford, where they're
not mentioned. Which you must know well from your time.
Indeed, yes. I was a regular visitor. I even played there a couple of times in sort of college orchestras. So it was an obvious resort of my imagination for this scene. So I shall just read the opening of this section. For their first date, he bought tickets to a concert and walked her there. Solemnly happy, neither had anything to say. Tom listened to the knock of his good shoes on the pavement, the sharp report of heels that made her taller, slower, a definite woman. A whitewashed space like a church, the luminous fade of evening against clear-story windows. Eleanor beside him, small again, compact and intelligent. He thought of leaning his thigh against hers, but she sat quite separately, her feet hooked at the ankles, swinging to a stop under her seat. Her hand claps like flapping cloth when the quartet walked on because of the gloves she wore. He leaned into the prickling air around her, close enough to smell her smell. The players rocked on their chairs, patent shoes creaking, their elbows pistoning in complex, staggered agreement. Not especially musical, Tom watched their faces go blank with concentration, or smile for a phrase, or, purse-mouthed, strenuously meet each other's gaze to establish a difficult convergence.
That was what I might call music from the broken word, Adam Foles's poem. Now, we're going to hear music for which you also have a visual connection, or it reminds you of a painter.
Yes, this is late piece of Debussy, which always brings to my mind Matisse and late Matisse for the simplicity of its gestures and the shape making of its phrases and its luminosity. It's very clear, strong colours, but also a great delicacy. This is Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola and Harp, which is one of three projected. Intended to write six towards the end of his life, and they're written against the background of his illness, but will prove to be fatal illness, and the First World War. And there's a terrible kind of pathos and delicacy in these pieces, I think, in which he makes a sanctuary for a kind of beauty and douceur, might be the French words, that he feels is very much endangered by the war and must feel in his own situation. So they have all the power, really, and deftness of a late star. They're very expert, simple gestures, which are really full of existential reckoning and a great love of the art itself and for itself.
Thank you. It is ravishing music. I think that's the right word for it.
Certainly. It leaves you somewhere else than where you were when you started listening to it.
The Pastoral, the first movement of the Debussy Sonata for flute, viola and harp, and we heard Roger Bourdin playing the flute, Colette Lequien, the viola, and Annie Chalin, the harp. As you said, Adam Foles, Debussy prepared the way, especially in his use of instruments, and also the influence of the East, the pentatonic scale and things like that, for composers that followed, like Boulez and Ligeti. And it's Ligeti next, a composer with a particularly remarkable ear. In fact, I notice that is something that you value very highly in all of the composers we're hearing, that there's a kind of precision in the way they actually manage to hear music and get it down on the page.
Yes, absolutely. I can't account for it, really, or justify it in any way other than by saying that these composers who orchestrate very precisely or have a very subtle sense of colour and instrumental combination are often the composers who compel me most, and I find a satisfaction in those crystalline sort of discoveries in sound that I value very highly, absolutely.
It's interesting, too, I think, that Ligeti and Kurtág, as it happens, both composers who, as you say, craft jewel-like pieces, and they were absolute taskmasters with musicians when they rehearsed them. What have you actually chosen?
I've chosen a song called Der Sommer, which is a setting of a Hölderlin lyric, which is a standalone song. It's not part of a sequence. And I think it's written at an interesting turning point in Ligeti's writing. It's the transition from those sort of large, microtonal, cloud-like pieces of the 70s into this alongside the horn trio, into discovering a language that sort of domesticates and makes viable for him certain kind of romantic gestures and ways of writing that ushers in the late great period with the piano etudes and the concertos to follow. I think it's a fantastic bit of word setting and a great achievement again in colour and precision to a remarkable extent, really, given that we're again just with a piano and a soprano, and yet he creates a world and a sense of space and radiance appropriate to the summer subject of the poem that is really remarkable.
And as you say, that the words are actually quite romantic in a way. There is yet time in the year, and the fields of summer stand in their glory, in their softness. The green of the plain is sumptuously spread out. The tranquil stream ripples through.
Absolutely, but I think it's of a slightly different world than English nature poetry that might have almost exactly that stanza in it. I think you feel in Hölderlin and Novalis and other German romantics this very powerful sense of immanence and of some transcendent presence that we are perceiving through the phenomenal world that conforms with the idealist philosophy that's there in the culture at the time. So I think Ligeti captures that as well, that what you're seeing is not merely a beautiful bit of landscape, but there's some huge cosmic presence in a way, that some kind of being that is made manifest in this poem and in these sounds. Thank you. speaking of that sense of cosmic encounter, so to speak, one thing that reminds me of, and I think is quite close to, although is very different, is that moment in Wagner's Siegfried, Act 3 of Siegfried, where Brunhilde wakes up and greets the dawn with that extraordinary sense of just being very nakedly in the presence of the world and relating to it in this sort of epic way. Wagner, someone else who fell by the wayside, who I would very much have liked to devoted an hour to.
Christiane Ulzer sang Der Sommer by Ligeti, and Irina Katayeva played the piano. Well, another composer who certainly broke the mould in many ways, and another song.
Indeed, one of three settings of Shakespeare that Stravinsky made late in his life, and they are form part of his serial works. It's a somewhat neglected occasionally corner of Stravinsky's work. He actually took on serialism, interestingly, I think, only after Schoenberg died. Clearly a very interesting relationship between the two of them and a great wariness about each other's musical territory and achievements. But perhaps liberated by the death of Schoenberg, Stravinsky takes on Second Viennese techniques.
And perhaps more, almost more Webern than Schoenberg in some ways.
Yes, I think for its distilled quality and its chiselled outline and its precision in its relation to silence, I think that's true. But you hear in other, I think in Agon, you know, with the mandolin in the, is it mandolin or guitar? I can't remember, in the ensemble, but quite a kind of Schoenberg-y ensemble in a way, I think.
Curiously, Emma Kirkby, great specialist in early music, of course, is absolutely right for that.
Indeed, yeah, there's a purity of line that consorts very well with this pared-down style of writing. Very penetrating, I think, that song.
Full Fathom Five from the three Shakespeare songs by Stravinsky. Emma Kirkby was accompanied by the Bâle Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. Now, given what you've said, Adam Foles, it will come as no surprise, I think, that you should be entranced by the musical sound world, the landscape, if you like, of Oliver Nussen.
Indeed, yes. He's a composer, I think, who has all of the virtues, really, that we've been talking about. He's someone whose music gives me tremendous and reliable pleasure, so I'm very happy to include some here.
To Organa, these pieces, why in particular?
I think they're a very good introduction into his sound world. They are two short pieces, the first of which is just a delightful toy, almost literally. It was written for, as I understand, for a music box and then orchestrated, and that's just a wonderful art object, like a Cornell box or something, you know, that's just entirely delightful. The second was written, I think, sometime later and is a bit longer and takes you on a different musical journey that's more intense in some ways. It moves through a number of moods and landscapes with remarkable rapidity and yet never feels hurried, feels entirely natural. It sometimes occurs to me that you're really aware of the technical skill of a composer in the transitions between passages, and here you may be in very different musical places that are separated by, you know, 10 seconds, and there are a number of them, and yet never do the transitions feel forced. Everything unfolds in a very natural and inevitable, but also very dramatic way.
Thank you.
To Organa by Oliver Nussen, the composer conducting the London Sinfonietta. Adam Foles, we come now to a composer who you talked about earlier as being, in a sense, at the pinnacle of this musical edifice.
In some ways, although he obviously is a very different composer, I mean, I think that's a truism about Janáček, it's very different to everyone. But what I admire in him is, I think he's a great writer and a great dramatic writer, because he writes entirely purposefully. There's never any sort of self-indulgence, there's never any waste or fat on a Janáček score. Everything is moving somewhere and expressing something. And I think you hear that very much here in the thing that I've chosen, which is The Young Vixen's Dream from his opera The Cunning Little Vixen, which is a moment of intense exhilaration, this sense of expansiveness and possibility and burgeoning life. It's a moment where the little vixen dreams of herself as a young girl, and so it's her burgeoning sexuality and this discovery of this larger world that is rendered in this music, but it's not in any way sort of wallowed in. You're not allowed the fantasy of dwelling in it, in this kind of artificial paradise, in the way that you might in Wagner or Mahler, you know, be invited to spend some time in this sort of magical garden. This is a real paradise, and it's brief, and it's menaced by interruption and is ultimately interrupted. So its instinct for reality feels very true.
Thank you. The Vixen Dreams, She's a Young Girl, Pantomime 2 from The Cunning Little Vixen by Janáček, and we heard the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Charles Mikeris. That's the recording with Lucia Popp as the Vixen. Well, finally, Adam Foles, you're going to have to introduce me to this music because I'm ashamed to say I don't know it.
Well, it's not terribly well known. This is a piece from another genre altogether. I thought I would add some variety and have some pop music, for want of a better name. And very hard not to choose Bob Dylan or Radiohead or David Bowie and various other people that I listen to a lot. But this is a band called Neutral Milk Hotel. One reason why they're not terribly well known is that they only produced two albums, one very good album and one really remarkable album, which I think this is. They're a group of musicians from the south of America called the Elephant Collective, and they configured variously under different leaders depending on whose project it was. And this album and Neutral Milk Hotel were the project of a guy called Jeff Mangum, who sort of subsequently disappeared, rather. I've seen written about as sort of the Salinger of indie music. He's become somewhat a messianic figure for his more zealous fans, made all the more intense by his absence from the scene. But this album is a really remarkably heartfelt and rich and complicated thing, a large part of which comes out of his reading of Anne Frank's diary, and it's rather sort of helpless and impassioned identification with her story and her plight, but also mixed in with this rather bizarre kind of fairground surrealism, which is a bit like the kind you might encounter in sort of early David Lynch. They're sort of two-headed boys in jars and things. Somehow it all makes sense and is all coherent, and as an album I think works incredibly well. Each song is a development and it absolutely hangs together as a piece. I think his voice is a very convincing instrument. It doesn't share the virtues of the other things that we've been listening to, with this great kind of expertise and aerobatic skill in deciding exactly where it wants to land. But the limitations of his voice are rather what gives it its emotional power. You feel him all the time struggling with something that he very urgently wants to communicate, and kind of up against the limits of his capacity to communicate it.
Ghost, ghost, I know you live within me. Feel as you fly in thunder clouds above the city into one that I love. With all that was left within me until we tore in two. Now wings and rings, and there's so many waiting here for you. And she was born in a bottle rocket, 1929.
I think that was your Antichrist that you served up.
Perhaps for you.
As you said, it's very interesting that, to hear something that was raw.
Yes.
As opposed to something that was very, very finely honed. That's really what I meant.
Yes, absolutely. Although listening to it at this time, I was much more aware of the continuity with my other choices in that very colourful and characterful instrumentation that you have there with the brass instruments and theremin as well. It's very distinctive
and surreal. And
bright. Yes, absolutely. So it does partake of some of the same kind of modernist excitements, although to different ends and with different means.
That was Ghost from the album In the Aeroplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel. Well, finally, Adam Foles, just tell us whether we will see from you next a poem or a collection of poetry or a novel.
Hopefully both in due course, but it's early days with things that I'm writing at the moment, so it's in the aircraft hangar under the dust sheet at the moment. And
many thanks for your very fascinating choice of music.
Well, thank you. It's been an honour to be invited. I've enjoyed it enormously.
Adam Foles was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the actor Julian Rhind-Tutt. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
On BBC Radio 3, Mark Padmore sings Schumann's Liederkreis. In a live Radio 3 lunchtime concert at London's Wigmore Hall, Padmore marks the bicentenary of Schumann's birth with one of his most celebrated song cycles. Join me, Susie Klein, tomorrow lunchtime from 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Well, a very good afternoon to you. This is Ian Skelly here to guide you throughout the afternoon today on Radio 3, which continues in just a moment with a profile of the European Union Baroque Orchestra, 25 years old this year. Music by Schmeitzer, William Corbett and Bach. All in a couple of minutes after a summer of the news with the time at 1 o'clock. It's read by David Cornett.
A Liberal Democrat MP has insisted that his Russian parliamentary researcher is not a spy. Mike Hancock confirmed that the woman, Katya Zatulaveta, had been detained and was facing deportation, but he said she would be appealing. According to the Sunday Times, she was arrested on suspicion of espionage on the orders of the security service, MI5. Iran has said it'll start using domestically produced uranium at one of its nuclear plants for the first time today. The uranium ore concentrate, known as yellow cake, was mined in the south of the country. Tehran's chief nuclear scientist said Iran was now self-sufficient across the entire nuclear fuel cycle. The government has confirmed that it's proposing sweeping changes to the planning system, which would allow people to make major alterations to their homes without having to apply to local councils. The reforms, which would affect England and Wales, will feature in the forthcoming localism bill. Thousands of people who are stranded in Spain because of a walkout by air traffic controllers are trying to get home. Most of the strikers went back to work yesterday, but passengers have been warned still to expect delays. The lawyer representing the founder of the WikiLeaks website, Julian Assange, has said the issuing of a warrant for his extradition to Sweden on allegations of sex offences is a political stunt. Mark Stevens said Mr. Assange would fight the moves to deport him from Britain. The Israeli authorities now say they're cautiously optimistic about bringing the huge forest fire in the north of the country under control. It had been thought that the blaze, in which at least 40 people have died, will take a week to put out. A spokesman for the Israeli firefighters said they now hoped to have contained the main fire by tonight. And the weather, it'll be a mainly dry afternoon with some sunny spells, and any rain in the south of England will ease off. However, there will be more snow in northern Scotland and wintry showers in coastal areas. Later, the temperatures will drop again and there'll be icy conditions overnight in many places. BBC News and weather at approaching 1:03.
David, thank you very much. E.T.A. Hoffmann's writings and ideas had a powerful impact on the music of his time. Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker is one big example. Well, this afternoon on Radio 3, you can hear how his influence made its way into a range of music when Stephen Johnson joins the BBC Concert Orchestra for this week's Discovering Music. That's at 5:00. But now we join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show.
The European Union, love it or hate it, it certainly made things a lot easier for us touring musicians in a practical way. But for those who still find the whole concept unsettling, one particularly worthwhile Euro enterprise should bring a warm glow: the European Union Baroque Orchestra. Founded in 1985, the EUBO, or UBO, has grown to become a truly multinational operation, its young players representing just about every corner of Europe. Auditions are tough, but those who make it can look forward to one of the most exciting years of their professional lives. Today's Early Music Show marks their 25th anniversary, and we'll be hearing from their current musical director, Lars Ulrik Mortensen, who I spoke to a few weeks ago from a studio in Denmark. First, though, something from their very first recording, made in 1991 under a former director, Roy Goodman. It's part of a collection of concertos by Englishman William Corbett. Each piece represents a different national style, and the one we'll hear is Alla Romana, representing Rome, and it certainly owes quite a bit to that city's most celebrated composer of the 18th century, Corelli.